From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the fifth and final segment in a series of conversations about the intellectual and political foundations of modern conservatism, with particular attention to Edmund Burke, the 18th century English statesman and philosopher. The panelists are Harvey Mansfield, Louis Lipsitz, Joseph Hamburger, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about theories of executive power. He's a professor of government at Harvard University. Paul Kress and Louis Lipsitz teach political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joseph Hamburger is a professor of political science at Yale University. Here is Harvey Mansfield.
We've been talking about American economic conservatism. What other types of conservatism are there?
I can think of at least one other type that seems very, I would say, prevalent, and that's the moral majority kind of conservatism, the conservatism associated with regulating not only your own morals but everybody else's morals as far as that's possible. And just how closely that connects with the Burkean tradition is an interesting question. I'm really not sure. In my feeling about it is that it doesn't connect very directly. But
isn't that a form of moralism and not conservatism, with the moral element being so prominent?
Good point.
Well, it's a different kind of. I don't know if we're quibbling over words or what, but there's a long. The conservatives do like to talk about the basic social fabric, the moral fiber, those shared values that make social life possible. For example, I remember reading an essay by Walter Burns about capital punishment, and one of the arguments he makes in favor of capital punishment is that this is a way society reinforces its moral fabric, and this is he would call it part of a conservative argument. The problem is, in modern societies, with the decline of religion or of shame, as we talked about it before, devices are left to prevent the social fabric from unraveling altogether, maintain a certain level of civility? And conservatives, it's on this point, I think, conservatives worry that the family's going to fall apart, and community life is going to fall apart, and individual morals are going to fall apart. Well, now someone has to intervene and make sure this doesn't occur. And I think part of the impulse for this moral conservatism, if you want to call it that, comes from this anxiety. But I think there's another factor, and I just want to mention this, and this is connected with religion a bit, and that's the... there's a certain quest for certainty here, desire to...
This in Burke or in the moral majority?
No, I think in the moral majority. And I think this part of it is... I'm of two minds about this. I'm not sure this is all that... It's alien to the Burke, the prudential statesman. But if you read Burke's attack on the French Revolution, there are a lot of eternal moral certainties for him in that attack. There are a lot of things he knows for sure are terribly evil, and things you can't compromise with that he sees in the French Revolution, atheism being one of them, and this overturning of the social order. And so I wonder if there isn't a certain parallel there.
And cutting off heads and dictatorship. I would have thought that those are moral certainties that we might share with him.
Burke's conservatism is not moralistic because for him the moral life is always so closely bound to the actual social life of a people, so that morality would never become the object of a crusading spirit, or should never become so. That, I think, would be the kind of morality or moralism he would oppose. Burke wanted morals to emanate from a society, but he also believe that morality required authority, and in that sense morality would have to be authoritarian. It couldn't be a free choosing of each person's own way of life by that person.
Right, so that morality was provided a structuring of the choices for individuals, and therefore a kind of a guidance for them. He would not have been happy with the kind of situation that we have today, in which any person is free to choose a lifestyle that is dictated by whim or a preference of any sort whatsoever. He would, I think, would have abhorred that.
He once said, "I do not know any such thing as a community of heretics."
Do you think he would regard a modern liberal society as a community of heretics?
It's possible. That would be a new discovery for him. But if a moral principle can be built into the fabric of a community, then I think he would find great toleration for it.
Well, here is where we see the difference between, I think, what Peter Berger calls conservatives by faith and conservatives by lack of faith. The conservatives by faith are the ones who have a hand, some kind of handle on certainty. And I think there is an element of that in Burke. He does think, as we said earlier, the prescriptive side of Burke, the religious side of Burke, sees that there are some eternal truths about society and about morality, about the nature of community. That's the conservative by faith, I think, in Burke. But then this conservative by lack of faith is the skeptic about change. The person who says, well, we have plenty of woes in the present, but we're not going to leap into some unknown future just because of the wild ideas of a few people who have a sense of justice or injustice. And that's the conservative by lack of faith. I mean, this seems to me to be a useful way to think about what conservative means. I mean, the conservative as the skeptic on the one hand, who's the critic based on long experience of disappointment of utopian schemes, and on the other hand, the conservative who still asserts there are eternal verities in religion or morality or politics. It seems to me two quite different things.
But do you think that Burke qualifies as conservative on both grounds?
Yeah, I do. Well,
that seems reasonable.
There's a rather subtle, intricate point that some liberal critics of conservatism make. I see if I can state it clearly, and it gets at I think people think of it as a sort of paradox, or irony of conservatism, that on the one hand, conservatives feel intensely about the preservation of traditional values, say the family, the community, fundamentals of morality. On the other hand, conservatives endorse rather unthinkingly the virtues of the free market, of capitalist competition, profit making. The point is whether there isn't a conflict between these two sets of values, whether the unqualified support for a free market economy, for competition, profit making, doesn't undermine the very values involved in family life, community, and stability of traditional norms. Can you have it both ways? Is it possible to say, let the market decide, and no matter what the consequences, and then fail to recognize that that position, with all the things that go along with it, the uprooting of communities, the problems of everybody in the family wanting to work and make a living, whether all of these things don't add up to the undermining of the values that conservatives claim they support in the first place. I mean, it's the Democrats who are taking what I would regard as a conservative position these days. And it's the conservative Republicans, the Reaganites with the Reaganomics, who are actually taking positions that I think from a Burkean point of view are threatening the fabric of society. That is, it doesn't matter to Ronald Reagan and his supporters whether industries fold up all over the frost belt, and millions of people lose their jobs, and then they have to migrate to new communities in the Sun Belt. That doesn't seem very Burkean to me. The Burkean point of view would be, here are people who are settled and have roots in a community. Here are patterns of life. Is it that important that we value the market that highly and the profit-making potential of developing the Sun Belt, that it doesn't really, that as a matter of policy, we're going to, in fact, even encourage people to move out of these, out of Detroit and Cleveland and the Middle West and move to Texas. Is that, I mean, from a Burkean point of view, my feeling is this is not very prudential policy. This is a kind of utopianism, believing that whatever the market dictates in the long run, and only the long run, is for the good of the society.
Harvey, how would Burke address that, for instance?
I'm not sure. I don't quite take Lou's view of President Reagan, but I do see that there is a conflict, or at least a tension, between society as inherited prescription and economic efficiency. Any conservative doctrine must somehow take care of that tension. Just as any liberal society must, or any liberal doctrine must explain who is going to replace the market, and why is that person or group of people more trustworthy than the free market would be.
Well, so does this mean that the conservatives today are indulging in a kind of a cultural nostalgia rather than a true sense of tradition?
It means that it's difficult to apply Burke to American conservatism today, not only because economics is so much more important for American conservatives than it was for Burke, but also because America has a tradition, but a tradition which is liberal and democratic. So to be an American conservative today is to be an American patriot. But an American patriot is, in some sense, a revolutionary, as it's been remarked that the most conservative organization in the United States is the Daughters of the American Revolution. That would surely have been a surprise to Burke. So, and this goes together with our American constitutionalism, and the veneration that we have for our Constitution is different than the veneration Burke had for the British Constitution.
Well, what's the difference? Why?
We believe in its principles more than in its practices. Those principles we find in the preamble, but especially in the Bill of Rights, in the amendments.
You mean it took us so long to come around to issues like civil rights, for instance?
But those issues were always implicit.
That's what I mean.
In the Constitution.
The veneration of the principle and disregard for what practical application it might have.
I wouldn't say disregard, but differing regard over time as to how these principles can be applied. For the American Constitution, principles are important. For Burke's British Constitution, institutions, or what he called establishments, are important.
I wonder whether the idea that there is a very important nostalgia strain in American conservatism shouldn't be looked at a little more closely. Recall this wonderful slogan of Reagan's during the campaign, the shining city on the hill, that we can make America what it used to be. Is there some kind of sense that really Thomas Paine's hope that this was the new world has somehow been a dream betrayed? And there's a need, at least in some sort of rhetoric, to recall the promise, to try to persuade ourselves that, you know, somehow it's still there, somehow we can still achieve it. And that's what I mean by the nostalgic element in it.
Yes, the revolutionary or Puritan sentiment that that you quote seems quite foreign to Burke. And so for an American conservative to appropriate Burke, there might be a problem of digestion.
Yes, I was going to say that some of the spirit of American patriotism is rather... as I suppose most patriotism is, though not all, very uncritical. And there's a strong tendency to see the United States as something rather sublime, almost beyond criticism, the standard bearer.
No, as the world's best hope. It doesn't mean it's the theoretically best, the ideally best, but given the state of the world, best hope. I think that's really what one finds in
that often goes along with a lack of self-criticism, I think. I mean, the kind of criticism that Burke makes of the British and the role of the British in India, the role of the British in the colonies that we talked about earlier, that kind of attitude is not Ronald Reagan's attitude.
But you just argue that Ronald Reagan is not a true conservative, so don't make him responsible for...
No, that's just what I'm saying. That is that a Burkean conservative, I think, would be less self-assured about the goodness we were doing in the world than is typical of the most patriotic types in the United States. Most people in American politics are Burkeans, but with a small b. I mean, they're very small-scale Burkeans. pragmatists, practicing prudential politics, listening, trying to find out where the shoe is pinching, responsive in that sense, respecting the traditions of the society. But there's not a great politics there. There's not a vision of politics.
Oh, there's a vision of politics, say, in Abraham Lincoln, our statesman who saved the Union. But one couldn't call him conservative, even though the result of his work was conservation. He himself spoke of a new birth of freedom, again, harking back to our revolutionary principles and trying to restate them to make sense for his time.
I think it's significant that Harvey mentions Lincoln, and not that he said that Lincoln was a particularly Burkean figure, but I think it's interesting that we look to leaders who emerge somehow in time of crisis. And in a Burkean politics, if it's well functioning, one would think that you wouldn't find those figures. If the institutions are strong, if the society is strong, you simply would not have. You would be maintaining essentially the excellence of what you'd achieved.
Yes, the the aristocrats with their landed property would be ruling the country
quietly,
quietly, if not sedately, and successfully. However, Burke was aware that new things arise. New things like the French Revolution, which those landed aristocrats he so much approved of did not foresee in the least. So I think there would always be need for someone like himself, someone to see ahead further than most statesmen can, or than any system can. I think that's an element. A person like himself is an element in his own political thought.
So he would assume then that societies that are frail, that there will be decay, there will be crisis, and there will be a need for some kind of restoration or maintenance of old values in new contexts.
Civilization for him is frail, I think. He was something of a valetudinarian of civilization.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the fifth and final segment in a series of conversations about Edmund Burke and the origins of modern political conservatism. The panelists were Joseph Hamburger of Yale University, Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Harvey Mansfield of Harvard University. Soundings now turns to a discussion with another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Alan Ballard teaches courses in government at the City College of New York. His new book focuses on his native city of Philadelphia and the emergence of the black middle class. The book is called My Soul Looks Back in Wonder.
Well, the book is really a study of the coming together of the black Philadelphia tradition, the old black Philadelphia tradition, which went back before the Revolution, and the Great Migration, which took place in 1917-1918. The first section of the book recreates the black community as it existed, right, up until 1900. I really build an intellectual tradition, a tradition of resistance, because to be somebody in black Philadelphia meant that you had to be a member of the Underground Railroad. And that was their mark of aristocracy, that in point of fact you had helped in the liberation of blacks in the South. I built that tradition on the one hand. I take these men and women and carry them into South Carolina. In South Carolina, I show how they interacted with the blacks there after the Civil War to help create a black Southern community. And I show how this black Southern community in turn came north in 1917 and 1918 and interacted with what was, by that time, an old black Philadelphia tradition. In 1866, many of the black Philadelphians who had helped create what I call a resistance tradition had either been in the army and volunteered with the black 54th Regiment during the Civil War, or had been in some active role in the war. Many of them were discharged and took their discharges in South Carolina. Having taken their discharges there, they became de facto leaders of the black community. Many of them came from poor backgrounds. They were artisans. Many of them were caterers. And as people got advantages, they would try to pass them on to their children. They created their own schools, their own private schools in Philadelphia that were black. From these, they created the whole basis for what I call an intelligentsia. That is a leadership class committed, basically, to change of the system. Richard Allen, who was the founder of the Black African Methodist Church, is one of the people I deal with earlier. William Still, who was the head of the Underground Railroad in Philadelphia, is one of the people I deal with in the earlier period. A man by the name of O.V. Catta, who was assassinated in Philadelphia when he attempted to lead the blacks to vote, is one of the people in the book. In South Carolina, I pick up others. A man who was the first black graduate of Harvard, Richard Greener, who came from Philadelphia to live in the South and who was a major leader of the Reconstruction there. At the end of the book, I begin dealing with what I consider to be the creation of the modern community in terms, for example, of Marian Anderson, the singer, Alain Locke, who is known as the father of the Harlem Renaissance, who was a Philadelphian and part of that old Philadelphia tradition. Arthur Huff Fawcett, who was a major figure in Philadelphia and a major figure in the Harlem Renaissance. Many of the athletes, I feel, Chamberlain, Greer, the entire kind of Harlem Renaissance, the team, I'm talking now again about the Wrens, right, the basketball team, they, three of those people were from Philadelphia, and they became the team, of course, that I think established black domination in basketball. They beat the Celtics back in 1937. And from that time on, it was a movement towards some kind of integration in basketball. So I deal with various kinds of aspects of that tradition, with athletics, with an intellectual tradition, with a musical tradition. Ethel Waters was from Philadelphia. Pearl Bailey was in Philadelphia. Ma Rainey and many of the other great musicians were part of that ethos in Philadelphia. Bessie Smith was singing there. There were great black theaters that were created in the city, and that became kind of a mecca for this interaction I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The book merges those two traditions in a way, the Southern tradition and the Northern tradition, in a way that just has not been done until now. Basically, it's been an assumption that there was a Northern community and a Southern community. I try to show how those communities interacted and how the black elite, or what some people would call the black elite, received its rational, or received its basis for legitimacy from protest activity. That basically commitment to the whole cause of black human rights was crucial to receiving merit in the community at all times, and that the black upper classes and the black lower classes have been more together than apart historically. In Philadelphia, I did a lot of oral history, that is, talking to people who had been influential in Philadelphia in the 1930s and 1920s. I talked to a lot of people who had migrated up from South Carolina and followed them. I kind of probe their memories of South Carolina. And from all that, was able to construct, I think, some kind of a sense of a community that was contiguous and together and whole and that had shared in one kind of experience. I make one argument all the way through, that the black community in Philadelphia has its main job basically to survive in the face of oppression. It has done that and more. It does not have the resources as it moves into a majority situation for the blacks in that city. It does not have the resources. It does not have the plants. It does not have the schools. It does not have the capital to create a beautiful city. Those resources, which are a result of 300 years of accumulation of property on the part of the white community, still reside in the hands of the white community. And I think that that has a lot to do with how the black Philadelphia community is going to face the 80s.
What does Philadelphia have to teach other American cities that are grappling with racial tensions and problems?
I think what it has to teach them is that until most Americans, and I think that this is really the problem for white Americans, understand the real degree of deprivation that was inflicted upon the black Philadelphia communities and Detroit and Chicago, that there will never be peace here. And there will never be peace because there will always be the clash between poor and rich. And until some commitment is made to change that. It's a question of white Americans feeling that they somehow or another have earned and merited everything that they have. And their sense that every attempt to help black people is a personal assault on their wealth, their property, their holdings, and unmerited. What I might try to argue in the book is that if they knew, or if someone had told them in school, that their factories, right, that their homes, that their resorts had been based on the accumulation of stolen capital from slavery, and that they had kept and maintained black people in that state through deprivation of voting rights, through separate and inferior schools, through physical onslaughts on blacks, through the use of violence and guns on blacks all this time, that maybe they would understand that there will be no peace in this country until they make the sacrifice in terms of the allocation of resources in a society in such a fashion as to repair that damage.
Alan Ballard teaches at the City College of New York. As a scholar at the National Humanities Center, he completed a book about the emergence of the black middle class in his native city of Philadelphia. The book is called My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, and it will be published this fall by McGraw-Hill. You've been listening to Soundings, Conversations and Comments from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.